you for being here today.
I'm thrilled, John. Thanks for coming. This is a...
That's the formal part.
This is going to be a interesting discussion, I hope, for you, because it's going to talk about how America intends to shape our future and not fear the future. That's what we're really here to talk about. There's some interesting challenges facing the country. Yesterday, one reason he was so nice is because I invited him to lunch at the White House yesterday.
Thank you.
He and Elaine came, and we had lunch with Hu Jintao, the president of China. And sitting there during the lunch, I was thinking about people's fears about whether or not we can compete against a country like China. You really think about a global economy and a global world. There's some folks that say, well, maybe we can't compete in the long run. My attitude is just the opposite. Not only can we compete, we must compete and remain the leader of the world. And that's what we're here to talk about, how you do that. And before I do that, I do want to thank John and the good folks here at Cisco for hosting us. It's not easy to host the president.
That's for sure.
Our entourages are quite large. But I thank you for having me. I am excited to be at one of America's most innovative companies. And I was asking John 20 years ago how many employees were there. There were zero. 10 years, maybe 6,000. Today, 47,000. Highly trained, highly competent, skilled folks that are helping to change America and countries around the world as well. So thanks for having us. It's wonderful to be in entrepreneurial heaven. I also am honored to be here with the governor. I cannot thank you enough for coming, Arnold. It's really thoughtful of you to be here. He is a really an interesting man. He didn't have to run for office, but chose to do so. And I admire that in you. I admire somebody who doesn't always take the comfortable way in life in order to serve something greater than himself. And I appreciate your service. I really do.
Thank you.
Traveling with me today is Norm Mineta, a cabinet secretary. Secretary, thank you for coming. Norm Mineta is a person who has been able to... He said, I'm glad to fly on Air Force One. I just wished you landed at Mineta Field. And his son David is here today. More importantly than son David being here is tomorrow, I think, is David's daughter's birthday. So we got the grandfather and the father. Thank you all for coming, and thanks for serving the country so well, Norm. I appreciate Mayor Ron Gonzalez of the city of San Jose joining us. Mr. Mayor, thank you for being here. I appreciate your time. I want to thank my friend Floyd Kwame, who is the co-chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, as well as George Scalise, who's with us as well. Thank you all for serving. I appreciate, there is Floyd, thanks for coming. And Leslie Westing, it's good to see you, Leslie. Thank you for coming. Appreciate your service in my administration. Our economy is good. It's real good. And we intend to keep it that way. The fundamental question is, though, can it be that way 5 years from now or 10 years from now? And my answer is absolutely if we do some wise things. I happen to believe it's wise to keep taxes low so that people have incentive to invest and save and spend. I know we're going to have to do something about energy. I am to be a competitive nation. Part of a competitive agenda means that we have got to deal with problems short-term and long-term, and we got a problem when it comes to our dependence on oil. I know the folks here are suffering at the gas pump. Rising gasoline prices is like taking a tax, particularly on the working people and the small business people. I pledge to the people here of California that if we find any price gouging, it will be dealt with firmly. I also recognize that our dependence on oil and in the fact that we live in a global economy, is causing gasoline prices to go up. And the fundamental strategy to keep us competitive is to get off oil. Tomorrow I'm going to be in Sacramento to talk about your very innovative idea of hydrogen-powered automobiles. I'll be talking about plug-in hybrid automobiles that will enable people to drive on electricity for the first 40 miles. I'm going to be talking about our investment in ethanol to make sure all of it, by the way, is aimed to making America competitive by changing our driving habits and our dependence upon oil. We have got to do so for not only economic reasons, but for national security reasons as well. It's really important for people to understand that as the Indian economy grows or the Chinese economy grows, they need fossil fuel, and as they buy fossil fuel, it affects our price. And therefore, it's in our national interest to diversify as quickly as possible away from our reliance upon hydrocarbons, particularly oil when it comes to our automobiles, and I'm convinced we can do so when we put our mind to it. A flexible economy, an economy that is not overregulated, is going to be necessary to keep us competitive. But the most important thing, in my judgment, to keep us competitive is for the United States to remain on the leading edge of technology and to make sure we got an education system that works. First, let me talk about technology. I do believe it is a proper use of federal taxpayer money to double the R&D commitment to physical sciences at the federal level. I believe it makes sense to spend taxpayers' money on research and development out of the federal government, because I have seen what expenditure of that kind of money has done in practical ways, and so have you. You may not realize it, but it was investment by the Defense Department that ultimately led to the Internet, which has kind of helped your business a little bit, John.
Hold on.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, tomorrow I'm going to be riding my bike in Napa Valley. I can't wait. I'll be plugged into an iPod. A lot of the reason the iPod exists is because of federal research dollars. And therefore, I think it makes sense to spend your money on research at the federal level in the basic sciences to make sure that the United States of America remains the innovative center of the world. Secondly, I recognize that most money spent on research comes from the private sector. I suspect you spend a lot of money on research.
About $3 billion a year.
$3 billion a year. I think it makes sense to encourage the private sector to spend the $200 billion a year we do total, $3 billion right out of Cisco. One way to do so is through the tax code, the research and development tax credit. Makes a lot of sense. Interestingly enough, the research and development tax credit expires on a regular basis, and therefore people have to come hat in hand to Congress and say, oh, save us, you know. Unfortunately, it is difficult to plan for some companies if you're worried about whether or not the research and development tax credit exists. Therefore, to keep us on the leading edge of change, to make sure we're the innovative capital of the world, Congress needs to make the research and development tax credit a permanent part of the tax code. People have got to understand that if we don't educate our children in math and science, jobs are going to go to other countries. It's as simple as that. The jobs of the 21st century are going to require a skill level much different from when you and I got out of college. You did get out of college, yeah. Look, I don't need to be talking. I barely got out myself, you know. But I mean, face it, we've got to have a different set of skills. History may not cut it. Math and science are going to be vital to make sure that this country educates the engineers, the chemists, the physicists, the types of folks that John Chambers and Francois are going to be looking for to hire. That's what we're really talking about. It starts, however, with making sure the public school system does its job in early grades. If I might, I'd just like to take a second to talk about the spirit behind the No Child Left Behind Act. I believe that the federal government should continue its role of providing money for Title I students, for the poor students. I think that is a good use of your money. However, I do believe that in return for the expenditure of that money, it makes sense for us to ask, whether or not we're getting our money's worth. That means whether or not a child is learning to read and write and add and subtract. I believe strongly that every child can learn, and therefore I believe there must be an accountability system in place to make sure that every child is learning. And so we passed the No Child Left Behind Act. Believe it or not, it was a bipartisan measure. Sometimes that can happen in Washington, D.C. Not enough, I fully concede, but it happened in this case where we passed the No Child Left Behind Act that says to California or Texas or any other state, develop an accountability system in return for this money to show us whether or not a child can read at grade level by the third grade and remain at grade level. That's not too much to ask, is it? And so measurement is a central part, in my judgment, of holding people to account, of being able to figure out whether a curriculum is working. We had all kinds of debates in Texas over the reading curriculum, what worked, what didn't work. The best way to determine what works is to have an accountability system. And that means the governor or the local school board can say, you were doing just fine when we compare how we're doing to the school district next door. Or if you're not doing just fine, it gives at least parents and those concerned citizens a tool to say, you got to change. You know, mediocrity is unacceptable. We're not going to accept the fact that children can't read by the fourth grade anymore in America. If you're a reformer, Chambers is a reformer. He is unwilling to accept the status quo. He can't afford to accept the status quo in order to be competitive in this world. The accountability system gives people the opportunity to say, we demand change. Interestingly enough, there is an achievement gap in America, but it's narrowing. Our fourth grade African American kids and our fourth grade Hispanic kids are beginning to improve in measurable ways, and that's really positive for the future of the country. And for the teachers who are working hard to meet the challenges of No Child Left Behind, the governor and I both thank you a lot. We're doing fine in eighth grade math, by the way, because we measure. But when the kids start heading into high school, the position of the United States relative to other countries for our beginning high school kids in math and science is not good enough. Like we're 15th in the world or something like that. We don't want to be 15th in the world. We want to be first in the world when it comes to teaching our children math and science. So here are some ideas. First, we ought to apply the same rigor to math that we've applied to reading. In reading, we measure early, and we've got supplemental service money, which means after-school tutorial money available for children who are not meeting standards. In other words, we measure and we correct. That makes a lot of sense. We need to do the same thing in junior high math. So the federal government is going to make supplemental service money available for students who are falling behind in math right before they get into high school. That's one way to correct the problem. It's to measure, to identify, and to solve. And that's what we intend to do through the new math initiative. Second, we got to make sure that we understand what works. And so I put together a national math panel with math experts that will help develop curriculum and teaching tools so that we can say to the states and local school districts, here's what the experts think. Instead of grasping for what might be relevant and might work, we're actually calling people together to know what they're talking about, just like we did in reading, and say, here's what you need to try in order to meet the standards. Thirdly, there are programs which work, and I bet you got them here in California, and it's called the Advanced Placement Program. It's a program that sets high standards and has classroom rigor. One of the problems we have is not enough teachers know how to teach AP. I'm going to ask the Congress to fund enough money to help train 70,000 teachers so they can become, prepared to teach advanced placement. I went to a great school in Dallas, inner city school. It's not one of these suburban deals. It's inner city. And, the principal claimed that they were the leading high school in the country in terms of kids passing AP. Texans tend to, put it out there, in a way that whether it's first or not, what mattered was there's a group of kids from all walks of life, different neighborhoods, all of them passing AP in math and science. They are going to be the leaders of the future. They're going to be our scientists and our chemists and our physicists. And we got to make sure that opportunity is available in more classrooms. Secondly, we went to a school the other day in suburban Maryland. There were two NASA employees there. These guys, as part of their job at NASA, were detailed to junior high classroom. And the reason why is, we call them adjunct professors. And the reason why is that sometimes it's not cool to be in the sciences. And these people make it at least seem relevant. And so we're going to attract 30,000 adjunct professors around the country to go into classrooms to say, this is why science and math are not only cool, but are the ticket to a great future for you. We've expanded our Pell Grants. There's now 5 million kids in America getting Pell Grants. It's a million more than 5 years ago. And I'm a believer in Pell Grants. I think they make sense. But at Tuskegee the other day, I announced a new initiative that provides additional incentive for high school kids who qualify for Pell Grants to take rigorous course loads. As a matter of fact, in the first 2 years of college, if you take a rigorous course load in high school and maintain a 3.0 GPA, you'll get up to $750 additional on your Pell Grant and up to $1,500 additional in your second year. If you take math and science or critical language in college and maintain a 3.0 GPA, you can get up to an additional $4,000 on top of your current Pell Grant. And the idea is to say that we believe everybody can learn, and there ought to be tangible incentives to encourage children to get the skills necessary to fill the jobs of the 21st century. One of the reasons I'm so pleased the governor's here is because there needs to be a collaborative effort between the federal government and the state government and the community college system and the private sector in order for us to achieve this important national objective, and that is for there to be excellence in math and science all throughout our society. And so the governor's here to talk about California's role into making sure that not only California is competitive, but that the country is competitive. Actually, you know, when California does things well, it affects the country. And so when you are a part of this competitive initiative, it'll help give confidence to others that we're doing the right thing. And so welcome. Why don't you share with us some of your thoughts about what you're doing here?
Well, thank you, Mr. President. First of all, I want to say congratulations on really paying attention to the competitiveness initiative. I like that. I think it's a great idea with the competitiveness initiative to remind the people of America that, yes, we have always been competitive, and we have been for a long time the greatest country in the world, and I think we can't be and stay there. But there are certain things that we have to do. It doesn't come by itself. And I think that we have to have a plan. And I think that the ideas that you have in investing in research and development, I think, is brilliant. I think that also to stress the fact of how important education is very important, and that you're going to put almost $400 million into the next year's budget to create more math and science teachers. I think this is really terrific. And we, of course, in California, we believe exactly in that. And I think that I want to even add something to that, and that is that we have to make sure that we are making it affordable for business to do business in our country and not to leave our country. I think we have seen that in 2003, for instance, in California, when I took over as governor, people and businesses were leaving the state, and people were losing jobs left and right, and we could not be competitive because of that. And then when we turned the business environment around here in California and improved the environment and made it easier to do business here and also less expensive to do business. For instance, just workers' compensation. We reformed with workers' compensation was the poison of our economy here in California. Businesses were hurting, small businesses, large businesses, farmers, local government, non-profit organizations. Everyone was hurting because of it. And just by reforming the system, having true reforms, we lowered the cost of workers' compensation by 40%. There's another 16% coming, so that's a huge victory, and it was a very clear signal to the business community that we are now, you know, paying attention to the businesses, and we want to make it a positive business environment. So because of that, businesses have come back, and of course, when you have savings, when businesses have savings like that, they're taking this money to hire more people, they're taking this money to expand the businesses, to buy more equipment and so on. That got really the economy going, and now we are seeing not only that we have produced 577,000 new jobs since November of 2003. But also we're seeing our revenues going up, our state revenues going up from $76 billion to $94 billion. So those are the kind of things that we have to do. So we have to make it affordable to do business. I think that's a key thing. And the second component, I think, that is very important is education. And I think that math and science, which is a national problem, but we have also in this state the same problem. John and I, we have talked about it many times. As a matter of fact, every time I get together with John, he talks about it, how important it is to produce more math and science teachers, that you have to go out there. You can't find enough talent in California, that you have to go out to other countries many times to search for that. There's no reason for it. I mean, we have the smartest people in the world right here in California. We should produce the best. Absolutely. Hey. But we should produce more math and science teachers. And, you know, so we made an agreement with the CSU and the UC system that they will produce math and science teachers. As a matter of fact, by 2010, we will have four times as many as originally planned. So we're going to really step it up and do everything we can to do that. And in general, we need more teachers, because there are a lot of teachers that are going to retire, not only in California, but all over the United States. We have to really pay attention to that, to create more teachers, because education, when you talk about, you know, reform, and when you talk about infrastructure, I think you have to talk about education. It's very important. And the other thing is, a third component I want to add here, and that is infrastructure. I think that we are not only failing the infrastructure here in California, and that's why we've been negotiating for 2 months to create great infrastructure and really build California for the future and for the increase in population. But I think the whole United States has to really pay attention to infrastructure. I think that's very important, because how fast we move people and goods around is the ultimate power of the economy. And I think that's something we have to pay attention to. So I, like I said, I'm very excited about the fact that the California people are hardworking people, that we have the most innovative people here, and a very resilient economy and everything. And I think because of the help of everyone working together here, we have been able to come back economically, and I think we will be competitive. So thank you again for your leadership, Mr. President.
Listen, thank you. Good.
Thank you.
One part of the infrastructure that John Chambers and I talked about today was to make sure that broadband is available. High-speed broadband is available to nearly every American. And we're and we're working it hard. We're making progress. I asked John today how we're doing. He said there's momentum. Uh-huh. But we got a lot of room to catch up in terms of being competitive. Other countries have done a better job than we have. But we're making progress. And the reason I bring it up is I just want you to know that I know it's important that we've got broadband highways all throughout the country so people can have access to it. One of the interesting things that the governor and I just saw was some of the amazing innovation that's taking place here in Cisco. So we get on, we're looking in the camera, and all of a sudden up comes four people, and it's like they're right here. it was an amazing innovation that that you're doing. And it just reminded me how important innovation is and why Cisco is doing well. It's because it's an innovative company with innovative people and an innovative CEO. And so, again, thanks for having me. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Mr. President, I think you said it right. The economy's good, jobs are good, and what we have today is because of our education from before. But we use network academies, and we put them around the world. It's a program that trains young people for getting jobs in the high-tech industry and using it in a practical way.
Yeah, network academy. What does that exactly mean?
Well,
some guy listening out there.
Yeah.
A network academy.
Well, it has a little bit of sizzle to it. A little. What it is it trains people to build that highway that you talked about. And it trains people, instead of getting jobs in areas that really don't have much demand, you get jobs where there's a lot of demand. In fact, we can't meet it in this country. And they usually get 30 to 50% higher pay because they've done that. The neat thing is we're training 100,000 Americans in this area. The challenge
Cisco
is...
Cisco is training the...
In network academies with our colleges and high schools. So we generate the program. The challenge, however, is our competition globally is even moving faster on the math and science. China and India graduate 10 times the number of PhDs we do. They have a population four times our size in each of those countries. We all do the math. That creates a challenge for us. So it's about getting the best and brightest in each of our organizations, and we have one of the students here who's just awesome at that. We've got to do better.
Yeah, again, so you took it upon yourself as a, you know, interested corporate citizen to provide employees to train others?
Started with a university system, an idea with one single employee, and we wired all of our schools, but nobody maintained it. Mm-hmm. So we began to train the students to maintain the system. It worked in one area, and then it spread globally.
Yeah. It's what John said is really interesting. It is very important for our citizens to understand that education helps you get higher pay.
And jobs.
And a job.
Yeah.
It's hard to get higher pay without the job.
You got me.
I know, you're building. But people have got to understand that, and one, it's not too late to go back to school.
It's true.
And secondly, there's a lot of really interesting opportunities to get the skills necessary to have the jobs that are going to be available in the 21st century. John Chambers just described one such avenue. You're doing 100,000 people, educating 100,000 people here.
In this country, yeah. 400,000 worldwide.
Yeah, I appreciate that. One of the interesting things about America is the fact that there are corporate citizens who understand the problem that America faces, and they're doing their part. It's amazing how much training goes on within corporate America, and I appreciate your leadership on this. And I hope others who are interested in making sure this country is competitive do their part as well to reach out and train people. Use your skills and your expertise to give people the skills necessary so we can remain a competitive nation. Mm-hmm. I suspect here in Silicon Valley there's a lot of job training going on, which is really important.
There is. We train locally, but we also are taking something, Mr. President, I think you would find extremely interesting. We took the terrible hurricane experience in our Gulf Coast, and we're working with Mississippi to redo their education system. We're putting $40 million of our own money into building a 21st century education system. We'll start with 52,000 students, seven school districts, and take one of the states, there's probably 49th in terms of math and science, and see if we can't make an example of where it goes. With the teachers becoming the innovators, with the students not having a digital divide, we'll put a wireless mesh over top the whole community, and literally building our students not just to catch up, but to lead in math and science.
I appreciate it. It's a great gesture. Thanks. Added value in education can come in all different ways, as I said, and one such place is in our community college system. You got a great community college system here in California. I know you're a strong supporter.
Yes.
Dr. Fong is with us, who is tell us what you do, Doc.
A lot of things.
Yeah. Well, you're the president of?
I'm president of Foothill College in Los Altos Hills, right near here.
Close friend, by the way, of Condoleezza Rice.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Stanford
doing well.
Buddies.
She's doing well.
And yes, she is. Please say hello to her for me. And we'll keep her out of the NFL if possible.
That's right, yeah. Please. I need her advice.
The community colleges, we think, are really a vast system that really could be one group that could address some of the issues that we just talked about today, whether it's math and science, whether it's workforce training, whether it's teacher education. We're very, very much interested in how we can improve this country's need for students who are going to be more competent in math and science, but also existing teachers. We have a program at Foothill right now where we're actually taking existing teachers and trying to give them expertise in technology. And so we're planning to expand that program into the areas of math and science. But one of the things that we also want to do is to really encourage our students to think about not only math and science, but also being math and science teachers, as the American Competitive Initiative talks about. And we think that we're really positioned to do that. Foothill alone has 17,000 students, but in the state of California, there are over 2 million students in community colleges, and that's almost half of the entire undergraduate population in this country. So we think that we do have a system that could really address some of these issues in a way that is scalable, that we certainly need the help of the federal government, of the state, and of industry. I do want to recognize all three of you gentlemen, that you, Mr. President, for recognizing the importance and role of the community colleges, and our governor for also doing that and actually giving us the financial support as well, and then for Cisco and for Mr. Chambers, because Cisco is one of the few major companies that has really understand the role that community colleges can play in undergraduate education, that we have a very successful Cisco Academy, that it is a way to train a workforce that Cisco does not need to then do itself, but to use the community college system to do that. But we also have an opportunity to work with existing teachers, so that rather than just waiting until 2010 for students who are like Roche here, who is coming out of college and maybe he wants to be a computer engineer, but maybe we'll talk him into being a teacher as well. But also, what about our existing teachers, and what can we do to increase their math and science skills?
Explain the academy, how Cisco works with you. I think people will be interested in this. I'm interested in it.
The Cisco Academy is basically a degree program, and they will get a degree in network enterprise, and they will also get a Cisco certificate, and it trains individuals. We start actually with high school students. You met two of our students today who are Foothill students, but they're actually currently also enrolled in high school. They want to be computer engineers ultimately, but they wanted to get a head start. So they're in our Cisco Academy. And so they learn about networking. They learn about all of the technology that is necessary. And so they're getting a college education. Basically, it's also eligible, I might add, for AP credit in their high schools. And then they are able to, if they wish to get a job right after the 2 years of the program. We have one student who is a Katrina victim, and he actually came to us last fall, and he's in our academy right now. He's one of the individuals you met earlier today. And we have many of our students were students who were laid off from the Silicon Valley after the dot-com bust, as it were. And one of our best examples is he came to our Cisco Academy after his wife read an ad in one of our publications. He went through our academy. Within 2 weeks, coincidentally enough, he applied to Cisco, and he got a job. He's now employed here full-time.
And it's called Cisco Academy because you helped design the curriculum?
We designed the curriculum, but it's implemented through the colleges and the high schools. There is no social promotion. The grades, everyone knows how you compare both within the states and globally.
See, what's interesting about the community colleges, and I know the governor knows this, is that they're about as market-oriented as you can get. Community colleges are available. They're very flexible. In other words, the curriculum can adjust depending upon the local needs. They're innovative. They're willing to take a Cisco program, implement it in the community college. They're very practical. In other words, they train people for jobs which actually exist. And it's vital, and I appreciate it. And I know the governor understands that, and we understand at the federal level. We've got pretty good grant money, $150 million in 07 budget, coming to help train workers. I just want people to understand that if you're wondering whether or not you're too old to go back to college, you're not. There's plenty of money available to help you go back. And 2 years of additional education can enhance your salary a lot. It makes you more productive, and a more productive worker is one whose standard of living will go up. And the community college system is, I think, one of America's greatest treasures. And I appreciate you, Dr. Fong, for being here. Thanks for your...
Well, the governor is also a product of our community college system.
Is he?
Right. Absolutely, yes. I just also want to just add that our community colleges are doing an extraordinary job with career tech and vocational education. And it's really amazing the kind of things that they do. And because I think it is so important to recognize that, yes, we want to stress four-year college, and, yes, we want to inspire kids to go to higher education and all those. But there's many kids that want to do and get into different professions.
Yeah.
They want to be a carpenter or a plumber, or they want to be a chef, or the computer technician or a nurse. Great professions with a great future and great salaries and all this. And I think that community colleges here in this state are really doing an extraordinary job to prepare them for those jobs.
Good. Thank you. Good job. Temp Keller.
Yes, Mr. President.
You know, I probably don't want to answer this question, but, like, how's a guy get named Temp?
She's actually sitting right over there in the third row. Yeah. Charter school, just up the road here, low-income community, and just saw firsthand that really two things. One, you know, I wasn't an anomaly. There was, you know, Teach for America and other programs and all sorts of colleges and universities trying to address this teacher shortage in this country by getting talent into the profession. But I also saw firsthand that more often than not, the folks that I really respected at my school, that I really looked up to, the ones who were really doing the best things for kids, they were the ones that were leaving, the ones whom we weren't retaining. And I just, it couldn't have been more clear to me that this country had been innovative in attracting talent to get into the teaching profession, and now there was an opportunity for this country to innovate when it came to retaining talent.
And so how does your deal work?
What we do are two very simple things. We essentially, one, identify good, effective teachers in low-income communities. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of people here in the room and listening that say, well, that's not an easy thing to do. The way that we do it, though, and what makes RISE truly innovative and truly unique, is that we ask teachers. We say to them, how do you know you're any good at what you do? You went into teaching to make a difference. Demonstrate that you're making a difference. Go to risenetwork.org. Fill out our online application and say, you know what, I've got all these choices of assessments. These are the ones that work for me. And I'm going to tell you, RISE, where my kids are vis-a-vis those assessments that I trust, those assessments that inform my instruction. I'm going to tell you where my kids are academically at the beginning of the year. And then I'm going to tell you where my kids are, my same students are, vis-a-vis those same assessments at the end of the year. But I own this as an applicant to the organization. And I say, here's how I can demonstrate with that beginning of year data and end of year data that I am getting over a year's growth, that I'm catching kids up, that I am closing this achievement gap. That's the first thing that RISE does. And the second thing, and the easy part, is because once we've got these good, effective teachers, these teachers who are doing great things, who are improving student learning, if you ask teachers why they leave, top three reasons, really in ascending order, first and foremost, they're isolated. Secondly, financial. Thirdly, and really the top driver of attrition, is work environment. So what RISE does is we say, well, gosh, we've got all these good, effective teachers. Now we're simply going to connect them with one another. Mm. There goes isolation. We're simply going to connect them with corporations and individuals, people who want to support good, effective teachers but don't necessarily have the infrastructure or capacity to find them on their own. RISE is the conduit to provide corporate discounts or dollars to these effective teachers. And thirdly, we help them find jobs. If they say to us, hey, RISE, thanks for the connections, thanks for the financial recognition, but you know what, I need to find a new work environment, we'll say, okay, if that's what we need to do to keep you in low-income public school teaching, we will do it.
Nothing better than being around a social entrepreneur.
That's right.
Here's your chance. How do you raise money?
well,
thank you.
I mean, so do the corporate California support your program?
They do.
California's interest that you succeed. So.
Most certainly. We have two revenue streams at RISE, and I am a social entrepreneur. I am somebody who's trying to build an organization, somebody who's not just saying, I'm going to go out and start a nonprofit, because you can certainly believe a lot of people have walked up and patted me on the back and said, oh, you got this thing going, that's great, you know, how noble, good for you. And I've said, you know what, it's not noble just to want to do good. It's noble to want to do good well. It's noble to begin an organization, to start an organization that has measurable outcomes, and that is how I raise money from philanthropy. I say to folks, look, I have two clear outcomes here. One, we're going to improve student learning in low-income communities because teachers are the key to student learning, and we're going to retain them, keep them there longer. And two, we're going to maintain this talent pipeline because Teach for America and other organizations are getting people in. Then RISE keeps them in. Then, you know, the KIPP folks, the new leaders for new schools, they train people to be principals. There's Broad out there training superintendents. And this is what we need to guard human capital as a real pipeline. And just quickly, the second way, the second revenue stream for RISE are the schools that we work with. We are a nonprofit organization, but we have a revenue stream. Because schools that we work with, when we have these teachers that say, you know what, Roz, thanks for trying to retain me in the school that I'm in, but I just need to find a new work environment, they become active job seekers in our organization, and we go and find schools that we call them emerging schools, schools that could be great provided they find effective teachers.
Yeah.
And then we simply say, hey, in a school that could make it provided it finds the talent, here's the talent that's looking. We provide that matchmaking service, and the schools pay us for it.
God, I love a guy who's enthusiastic about what he's doing. Thanks. By the way, I also know East Palo Alto.
Absolutely.
Vermeil, my buddy Vermeil. Actually,
of course.
Had the students come to the South Lawn one time.
Yep.
Most definitely. Great school. Thanks. Thanks for doing what you're doing. Francois.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Step up to the mic there, my man.
Hi, my name is Francois Henley. I'm the president and CEO of a small Silicon Valley company called Silicon Genesis Corporation, or SciGen. What we do is we use nanotechnology to make semiconductor materials perform better. The chips will run faster. They're built on silicon substrates or wafers, so to speak, or maybe your cell phones will last longer on the same batteries. What we do, however, is after we have developed our processes, we license it, and therefore what I saw in the American Competitiveness Initiative, Mr. President, was very, very important, and that is the emphasis that's placed in the patent reforms. Patents are very, very important to small companies. They're the great equalizer, and patents need to be fair, need to be efficient, and really it's a kind of a reflection of a free society, in my belief. I think that the reforms are very good, and I believe that I'd like, however, perhaps to be involved maybe in some capacity to make sure that they stay. It's a very difficult subject, and there's a lot of moving parts to it, but I think it's a good thing, and I fully support it. The other thing that I think is very important for small companies that I saw in the ACI is the fact that there's a substantial rise in the amount of federal funding.
Yeah.
And that's very, very important to companies who really have to leverage some other research to make some kind of difference in the world. As a small company trying to make a difference with some core technology or patentable technology, the federally funded labs, the Department of Energy, and one actually that I just met recently, the National Renewable Energy Labs in Golden, Colorado, was just doing tremendous work, and we really can leverage that work. And I think there's a recognition in the ACI, which is very interesting to me. It really is a recognition that invention can't really be planned. But I think the ACI generates an environment in which fosters innovation and new ideas. And it's interesting how different, like the iPod, Mr. President, that you said as an example, certain things happen where you hadn't planned on it, but you did the foundational work. I think that is so true as the CEO of this company, but also as an inventor myself. For example, so the work that I mentioned that we do in semiconductor, we just found out, has a tremendous application in solar cells, making them less expensive, making them perform much, much more. How could we have known that until we've actually figured all this out? So the leverage is really there with the funding. And, of course, the tax credit really allows private sector to plan on doing directed R&D. This is where there's some risk, and it really incentivizes risk takers, and I think that really is a good thing. And I truly believe as well, Mr. President, that you do get a lot out of those investments, many, many ways. And I also believe that education is not only in college, parts are in the ACI, but also in the earlier areas such as elementary and high school, and I think that's very, very important. One thing that brought this to mind was I read an article. This was a talk that the late Dr. Richard Feynman, who's a Nobel laureate from Caltech, gave in the mid-60s to the National Science Teachers Association. It's very interesting, and I completely believe it. He said to the teachers, look, do math and science very well, because by the time that the students get to college, they either become innovative or they do not. And I believe that everybody can be innovative, but it really needs this kind of nurturing at the outset, and that is why I really believe that the math and science curriculum at the K through 12 is very, very important. And perhaps my last point that I saw in the ACI is immigration. The paragraph in there that basically says we really would like to make it easier for the best minds in the world to be able to come to the United States either to learn and also to contribute. And I am one of those. I'm originally from Montreal, and I came to the great universities, Berkeley, as well as Rensselaer, in the United States, and I believe that's absolutely the right thing to do. So I think there's a lot in the ACI that positively affects small companies like mine, as well as large companies. So
Did you start this company?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. You know, we want people coming here or who live here to feel comfortable starting their own business. I love the fact that I am the president of a country where people can start with nothing except an idea and desire and hard work and end up owning your own business. And Arnold was right. We got to make sure the environment for entrepreneurship remains strong throughout our country if we want to be on the leading edge. How fantastic is it that a guy comes from Montreal to realize his dreams? And it's we're employing people. Who knows? You may hit on the thing that makes solar energy the source. I actually believe one of these days we're going to have homes that become little power generating units unto themselves. And if you don't use electricity, you'll feed it back into the grid. And maybe you're the guy. Maybe one of these days.
I have the pitch.
Yeah.
Right here.
So don't take this marketing too far. You know, you one camera back and he goes crazy. But thanks for coming. I love your story. Good luck. I wish you all the best.
Thank you, sir.
He talked about patents. Basically, he's talking about making sure it's easy to protect his ideas. What also I want you to know that I talked to President Hu Jintao about, and I know John Chambers says as well over in China, is we expect the same treatment for our products that are patented here in the United States overseas. Intellectual property rights is a vital part of making sure a trading world is a fair trading world. And I spent time yesterday with the president in a very respectful way, but a firm way, reminding him that if he's to be a good trading partner with the United States, that when Cisco sells a product there, or you know, Francois eventually sells a product there, that property needs to be, that intellectual property inherent in that product needs to be protected and respected. Final person. We're saving probably the best for the last. Wouldn't you say, Arash?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. President. That's right.
You are a dash student.
Yes.
Where?
I'm a computer engineering student at San Jose State University. I'm also minoring in mathematics as well as film acting.
Interesting. So, yes, I got the strategy. Why did you major in the first two subjects?
Sure. It's the first time I've been asked that.
Yeah.
Well, I decided to do computer engineering because all my life I've been a complete computer nerd, always playing with computers, electronics, taking them apart, destroying them. I mean, my parents wouldn't really let me go too close to the television without, you know, somebody to supervise, but that's basically
And your dreams.
I hope to, after I graduate from San Jose State University, I want to go on to pursue an MBA degree and hopefully start a small business designing consumer electronics components, plan A, plan B, to go into a small startup where I can help lead the direction of the product design department.
Right. And so when did you start having this kind of notion about where your life would like to go?
I'm glad you asked that. Well, basically, back when I was at San Jose State, in my sophomore year, I started getting involved with student government. And one of the first things that I did at student government, and this is a funny story, so I'd like to tell it,
sure,
is we had credit card vendors that would come on campus. And these credit card vendors would harass students, hey, we'll give you a free shirt, we'll give you a free radio if you sign up for, you know, a credit card. And what would eventually happen is these students would get these applications in the mail, and every time they'd get one, they were getting a background check done. So it was actually hurting their credit score. And the West Coast is actually known for having the hugest amount of debt for exiting college students that are graduating. Mm. So I passed a piece of legislation through the student government, which actually the governor, Governor Gray Davis, had signed into law a bill that said that you could not harass students on campus with commercial products in exchange for gifts. So that passed. They changed all the rules. And after that, I decided, you know what, why not go for student body president? Ran, got elected, and after that decided, well, you know, the world is the oyster, so why not go after an MBA degree after computer engineering and see where it takes me.
Great. You know what's interesting? Why don't you tell folks your family history real quick, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I'm an Iranian-American, and my parents, who are sitting right back there, are from Iran. My mom and dad came here at around 1980, and me and my sister were born here in San Jose.
I love America, a country that welcomes people. We've got to be a welcoming society. And, you know, our soul is renewed when people escape societies that can be really repressive. And I have a son like Arash. He sits here with the president and the governor talking about dreams. See, this is a country that has always got to be a place where people can dream big dreams. And I see it. The question facing America is, will we lose our confidence and become an isolated nation? Will we lose our confidence in our ability to compete in the global marketplace and become a protectionist nation? And the answer is absolutely not. We will not lose our confidence. And here is part of our strategy to make sure that the United States of America continues to be the leader. And it's important for people to understand that being the economic leader of the world means that it's more likely you'll have a better job, and it's more likely you'll be able to realize your dreams, and it's more likely our standard of living will continue to rise. And that's the challenge ahead of us. It truly is. And I want to thank those who are here to help make the case why our citizens have got to be confident about the United States of America's place in the world, and why we should never relinquish our standing in the world because we fear the future. We welcome it. We welcome competition, and we know we got to put a strategy in place to be able to deal with that competition. And you're hearing the foundation for that strategy here today. I want to thank you all for lending your expertise. Thanks for joining me. God bless you all.